With our very special guest tonight, Marshall Masters, as we talk about Planet X. We'll be back with Marshall in just a moment. Marshall Masters with us. Marshall, what about Nostradamus? What did he have to say about this and his prophecies?
Well, George, this is the one thing that I really found interesting was, A&E put out a show called The Lost Book of Nostradamus.
Right.
And in that, there's one of the plates and where Nostradamus is making very specific predictions that this object, this harbinger object, would arise out of the constellation of Fucus. Now, Fucus is near Sagittarius. It is what's called the 13th constellation of the zodiac. And this was something that was used by astrologers. And then when they went to setting up what we now have, which is evenly divided, more easy to work with, the Fucus was set to the side. But it's still always been a very important constellation. When the guy that came to me about this blue-bonnet object that we're observing, and he came to me just before the end of last year, and he's an expatriate American. He is a college administrator, retired, and he's been watching this webcam for the Turrialba volcano, which is on the 10th latitude.
Okay.
And what he saw was this object was appearing in the afternoons. Now, they all watch it down there because he lives at the base of this volcano, and they want to know when it's time to start running downhill, screaming, "Feet don't fail me now." That's when he noticed this thing popping up. Well, I started tracking it, and at first, I didn't pay attention to it when the guy sent it to me. One of the first pictures he sent was actually a moonrise. That was easy to debunk. The second time, I was looking at it, and I was going, well, that could be Venus, but then it really wasn't Venus because it was way too far off of the ecliptic for Venus. And I still was really undecided about it. I didn't, and like a lot of people, you don't want to even look at it, but he just kept coming at me and saying, because it was really tasking him, it was really bothering him. And he said, just please, you know, this thing shows up around 3 o'clock in the afternoon and stays there until around 5:30. Well, if you have an object that's close to the sun, you're going to see it before sunrise, or you're going to see it before sunset. That's where you're going to see it.
Right in between. That's right.
That's right. So this thing is obviously very close to the sun. I've been studying a lot of these two suns of the sky photos that people have been reporting on the internet, and particularly with cell phone images. But this is a high definition, fixed mounted surveillance camera with a very good lens at about 10,000 feet. Pointed west by southwest. And sure enough, I sat there and it was a good viewing day. Not every day is a good viewing day. Turrialba is a very humid area. You can see humidity over 90% quite often, even at that altitude. So you have, and then plus it's an active volcano with vapor rising up off of it from the venting, plus passing clouds, and then you have cloud banks. And the vapor and the passing clouds, those are tens of meters thick, whereas your cloud banks are tens of kilometers thick. And from this volcano, you can actually see as far as the Pacific on a very clear day. Well, I sat there, and I got the object, and I just started watching it. And I watched it for almost 2 hours.
How big does it look?
And in terms of size, I would say that it looks about the size right now of Venus, a little larger than Venus would look, and also much more clarity and definition.
Okay.
And what we're noticing now is it's actually about twice that bright, twice that big, twice that bright. It's reached a part of its orbit where it's starting to go down again towards the ecliptic. And this is a pattern that we've just now detected in this all this information. And we have found a database of images from this volcano surveillance camera in different places. We found as early as 2010, where the object was showing up around a little bit around 5 o'clock in the afternoon for maybe about 5 or 10, 15 minutes. Then as it proceeds into 2012, it's longer duration viewing. We got a really good find on a lot of historical imagery from the United States Air Force School up in Alaska. They had an archive. We downloaded that archive. Plus everything that we've been capturing continuously on our own. Each and every day, I have a team of four people, and the archivist is Barbara, and I have Jack, and I have William, and I have Ed, and everyone's working on it every day. Somebody's watching this object and downloading imagery on it, as anyone else could do. The thing is, George, nobody wants to look at it.
Why not?
Fear.
Fear of what? Fear of what, Marshall?
Fear, it's
I would find it to be just unbelievable.
You know, I thought the same thing at first. George, honest to God, I'm looking at it. I'm saying, you know, for years we've been carping and complaining about the fact that, you know, somebody saying, well, show it to me. I got a piece of paper and a pencil, and I'm waiting for you to give me the coordinates. So what I'm saying, here's the web link, here's the URL. Go look at this thing and explain it. And what happens is people will look at it for about 5 seconds, and then they run away from it because they look at that, and I think it just must tap into some deep racial memory of a very bad time. Because there's a fear reaction. And the fear reaction, here's the thing that boggles my mind, George, is that the fear doesn't matter how technically illiterate or literate you are. As a matter of fact, what I have found in this is that the folks that come to it with the heaviest science backgrounds are the ones that have the most violent emotional reactions to it. People who are not technically illiterate look at it and go, nah, that's trouble. I'm not going to do it. And they walk away. The other ones will go to insane trivialities, and, you know, which is fine. I'm bringing it on. Let's try and debunk this thing. Let's disprove it. And so there's the all range of these trivial theories. It's Venus. It's a reflection. It's a refraction. It's a scratch on a lens. It's this. It's that. And so when you have as much data as we have, this is not something, George, where I have one picture and I'm trying to get the whole world to believe in one picture. I'm sitting here with 1,400 images in my database. So when I say to my team, we're going to do a natural progression study, here's what I want. I want imagery where I have the sun and the object in the field of view, very clear. And I want to have them as spaced apart, as regular as we can. And the problem we have is when we go back into the database, we have so many of them that'll pop up. We have to start cherry picking and sifting through the ones that we want to do. So we have all of this. And every time I go back to this archive, I can, you know, a debunker is going to go, I'm going to say, is this a real object? And they're going to go, well, no, it's not. And I say, why? Because of this, this, and this. All right. So if it had been a real object, what would I have seen? And they go, well, it wouldn't have been this, this, and this. It would have been that, that, and that. Okay. So I go back to my archive and I come back with a pile of that, that, and that. And I show it to them. And what do they say? Aha, it's a reflection.
So go, they won't admit it. Said,
they won't admit it. And I say, why is it a reflection? They say, because it's that, that, and that, which means it's not this, this, and this. So they get into the securitist logic. They can't withstand scrutiny on their debunkings. And when I come back and I throw the evidence at them, they explode in my face, call me names, and storm off. But I can't get somebody to cold and sober be a good cynic. I'm looking for a good cynic here. I'm looking for somebody that can come to me and say, here's what explains everything you're seeing. I can't find that. Nobody has showed up to tell that story yet.
Where do you think Planet X is right now, Marshall?
Well, it depends on what we're going to call Planet X, because it's obviously what we're looking at. You know, for years, George, I've always maintained Planet X could be anything. It could be a comet. It could be, you know, a rogue planet. It could be whatever it is. What we're seeing right now, what's the only thing that explains the data that we're seeing now, particularly now that we have started doing our natural progression studies, is that we're observing an object that is the outermost satellite of the mini constellation that is currently under observation by 00 Skyview, and which was disclosed in disclosure videos in 2008 by three different people, and those shut down about as fast as a New York minute. I mean, one guy, I was lucky. I got tipped by somebody who knew what was going on. I was able to download that video. It was DNR 8 something. They're really kind of an arcane name. But his video was only up for about 8 hours, and his video was not only pulled, the account was terminated. Blip.
Hmm.
Okay? And with YouTube, you know, you get one mistake. He didn't even get one mistake. They just tossed him. So what I think we're seeing right now, George, all I can say is that I'm looking at the data. And that's the reason why I'm hoping to God I get permission from someone to go down in Costa Rica, the Irizu volcano, which is open at 11,000 feet, and it's at the ninth parallel. It's within 50 miles of the other volcano, and to see if they can get a boots-on-the-ground observation. Because if they can, then what we're seeing, what we're watching right now with my team, we're seeing the outermost satellite, which would be the blue kachina of Hopi prophecy. Whereas,
and what do the Hopis say? Let's review just a minute. What do the Hopis say about the blue star?
Well, the blue star is the one we see first, and it unmasks. It becomes suddenly visible. And this is very, very consistent with ancient historical accounts that we have found in the Colburn Bible and elsewhere that says when this thing shows up, it comes out of nowhere. I mean, it just caught them by surprise. Now, look at it this way. The ancients, when it came to astronomy, in terms of our solar system, you know, out to Saturn, hey, they were the past masters. They're still teaching us stuff. Today, what do we have? We have, with all of this freakish weather that we're having, there's huge amounts of vapor that are up in the air right now. We have chemtrails spraying like crazy. So if you are below the cloud cover, visibility stinks, especially, you know, with most of us being in large cities with light pollution, with all of these other factors. Whereas if you're above the clouds, it's a whole different ball of wax. And I think that what we could see is a 1-2 situation where if this is a real object, and I tend to think now that it's going to be incoming. In other words, we're closing on it. The reason why is we go back into the historical data, particularly the images that we pulled off that U.S. Air Force site. And when we're looking at that and we're doing our natural progression study, the natural progression is just simply saying you're observing it as it happens. That's it. How does this thing behave at different points along the way? What we see is when it's acquired south of the ecliptic, it's bigger and brighter. As it moves towards the ecliptic, which is the plane of the system, it becomes smaller. And also, we don't have the crescent terminator that you're going to see. It's like a full moon, but it's half the size. Then as it starts going north, up above the ecliptic, what's happening is that it starts increasing in size. So what that tells me is we're closing with it. Because right now, I can tell you that, you know, when I started looking at this, because my archivist is feeding me, cherry-picking samples for me on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. She's pulling down multiple copies. Barbara's doing a fabulous job. And I'm looking at one, and I'm going, hold on a second. I went back to my stuff that I had done in the first week of January, the captures I made, and I compared it. And the object is nearly about 2.5 times the size and the brightness of when I first saw it in January. So that means we're closing on it, and it's also coming south of the ecliptic. If we use the timing that 00 Skyview is using, and they're actually making infrared observations of the mini constellation and the dark star at the center of that constellation, and what they're saying is this summer, midsummer, it's going to become visible, which would mean the object that we're looking at would come visible before that, perhaps in May. And that'll happen. For me, I'm saying if we get corroboration on this, then we know what to look for. We get through the summer, we get through, well, basically, we get through the end of the year. We can breathe easy and just say, okay, we got spooked by some ghosts.
Will this be difficult to hide?
God, difficult to hide. You know, people look at it and they can't believe what they're seeing. That's the thing that stuns me, George. You would want to run out and see it. I would want to run out and see it.
In a heartbeat.
And a lot of people say that they would. But when it gets right down to it, nobody wants to see it. They want it. What they want to do, the instant they take one look at that, the reaction, I don't care if they have a degree in physics or they drive a truck. I don't care. I see them all doing the same thing.
What is that?
They lock the closet. They turn on the bedroom lights. Crawl in the bed and pull the covers over their head, because if the monsters don't see them and they don't see the monsters, no harm, no foul. It is this bizarre. This object is, to me, it's a mystery. It's an enigma. But people have this gut, visceral kind of reaction that just seems to reach down into the core of our racial memory.
Are they afraid of this object?
Yes.
Are you?
I'm not afraid of it. I'm trying to solve a mystery. If the mystery, and it's going to have one of two possibilities. It's the sum of all fears, or Marshall's chasing a ghost. If Marshall's chasing, he'd all have a good laugh at my expense, and you're going to have to laugh louder than I am. But I can't debunk it. Nobody can debunk it. I'm the one that I sit there and I go, I've had nights where I just lay there and it grinds and I go, aha, if it's thus and such, I should find this. I go down, that's what I find. Even when I'm pulling the most wild, crazy debunking ideas out of my head, I can't debunk it. Nobody else can. That is, and that's the reason why I am just, please, somebody, if you have a friend in Costa Rica, pick up the phone and say, hey, go to Ira Zoo in the late afternoon before sunset and see if you can see it, because they should be able to see it from that other sister stratovolcano that's within eyesight of Turrialba.
Marshall, when we come back, I want to talk about, believe it or not, Mayan prophecy. You believe it's still around, so let's find out when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. You can chat with Marshall Masters about Planet X. I'll be back with him and much more on Coast to Coast AM. Marshall, how big do you think the object is, the planet, Earth size?
It's going to be a large, this is going to be a planet-sized object in Earth size. It appears to be that way, somewhere between Earth and Venus in size.
Now, with it being that big, why can you really only see it from a certain location?
There's a number of different factors. First off, it's coming up from the ecliptic or near the ecliptic, and it's also very close to the sun.
Okay.
The thing that's really important, I was fortunate enough some years ago when I was on vacation in Hawaii, I went to Haleakala, the observatory.
Okay.
That's around 9,000 feet. But I watched a sunrise, and I watched the sun come up from beneath the clouds. And, you know, when you could actually see the curve, you know, you can see the curve of the earth, you can see the ocean out there. You see things much further and in much more clarity than you can below the clouds, which is why you have these big observatories on tops of these mountains and on top of these volcanoes, because that's where the optimal viewing is. You get below the cloud cover, all right? Now it's a different problem because you have all of the things that are obfuscating. We had some interesting research. Last year we had two observation sightings that people saw two suns in the sky with their eyes and then took cell phone images. One was using a BlackBerry, the other one was using a 4S. And in both cases, we had strong images and we had personal accounts from very credible people, but we couldn't authenticate them. But that did clearly show me something, because in both cases, these two people who had eyewitness observations were near sunset at altitude on civilian flights. So that told me two things. They're above the chemtrail layers, and they're above the cloud layer, and it's before sunset, which would be consistent with it being an object near the sun. That clued me into that. So it's this, you know, it's a special kind of keyhole effect where you can see it, but you have to be at the right place and you have to be at the right time until it comes to a point where it's in everybody's face. I don't care how many chemtrails they spray, we'll see it. But right now, it's incredibly difficult to see it below the cloud layer. But if someone's flying, you know, for months now, I've been asking folks, when you're up there, go get yourself a pair of the, you know, because you're looking in the direction of the sun. I don't want anybody to hurt their eyes.
Oh, you got
to
be careful.
So I asked them, so you have your sunglasses, but it's much better. For a few dollars, you can go and on the astronomy sites and Amazon or whatever, you can get those eclipse viewing glasses, those little things that look like the old TV glasses that we had at the theaters.
Yeah.
You can get those. They'll protect your eyes. You can use that for the observation, but also use it for the camera as well, and to go out and do that. And so I've been asking for folks that are at altitude on civilian flights near sunset. And one of the things you have to do is just make sure you know the direction you're going in so you can book on which side of the plane that's facing. So we've already seen this trend where it's observable from different places. You know, one case it was Japan, and the other case was Australia. So that for me says, all right, it's altitude and visibility. What kind of viewing sky do you have? Those are the critical things. So for now, we're really just dealing with locations that are going to either be extremely high altitude, 35,000 feet, all right? If not, you've got to be as close to the equator as possible. Costa Rica is pretty close to the equator, and along that 10th parallel, all right, what do you got? Ho Chi Minh City? Like, what are they going to see? It's, they're a few feet above sea level. What are they going to see? You know, you've got the folks out there, I think Caracas, Venezuela, they're at about 2,000 or 3,000 feet. They're not going to see it. But here's another thing that is consistent with Turrialba, the volcano, and the at-altitude images, is that when you are high up, you actually, your sunset time frame is longer. Now, imagine you're in San Jose, Costa Rica, which is around 3,000 feet above sea level. And it's a little further west of Turrialba. When people are sitting there and they see the sunset, because remember, they're looking at the nap of the Earth, all right? They're looking out straight across at the nap of the Earth. And so consequently, when the sun sets in Costa Rica or in San Jose, Costa Rica, things are just getting interesting from Turrialba, which is 7,000 feet higher up. And the reason why is you have that angle of view. So you actually have a prolonged sunset. That's the kicker here, is that's what makes it, that plus the viewing sky, that you have this absolute clear viewing sky. But it is this consistent pattern, whether somebody's in an airplane or they're on top of a volcano, they have this additional, if you will, extended sunset period. And this really goes to, particularly in the case of the 2010 imagery, there was this fellow, I think his name is Rodolfo, and he's a technical guy, works for a technology company there in Costa Rica. And for some reason, he just had an interesting thing to go and capture video. Well, and he amassed quite a bit of it throughout the year. And this was the only source we had. What we saw was in January, there was no absolute sign whatsoever. So we know that as of January 2010, it wasn't showing up. But in mid-February, we started seeing it popping up for a few minutes close to sunset. And then that trend just keeps going forward. So when people are saying, is the Mayan prophecy wrong? You know, my thing is on that, well, first off, the universe is not unfolding at the speed of human expectations. And the smart thing to do, what I tell my team all the time, I repeat it, it's a mantra. I'm sure they're sick of hearing it, but I always say the same thing.
It works.
Believe nothing, observe everything. Observe it. See it in situ. See it where it lays.
So you don't think the Mayan prophecy is over by any means, do you?
No, we've entered into it. I think that what's over is the nonsense hype.
Right.
You know, particularly like we were all going to wake up on December 21 and sing Kumbaya and buy the world of Coke. That didn't happen. At least sure not in North Korea. But, there was a lot of hype on 2012. And I think there was a lot of hype that I saw this hype being generated around the Common Elanin thing. I've seen this kind of hype generated before. And I will say, back in 2003, that has always been useful for me with the Nancy Leader and the Mark Hazelwood thing. And I spoke with Nancy about that a lot. She was really angry with Hazelwood because he plagiarized her work. But the...
Let's say that allegedly, huh? I don't think he was ever nailed for that.
Well, you know, Nancy sent me a copy of the cease and desist letter her lawyer wrote for her.
Yeah, but any lawyer could send
it. She didn't have the money to pursue it, that's all.
I know.
So, you know, it was, if you don't like it, you got to lump it. What are you going to do?
I know. But you know, you can't say somebody plagiarized that when he's never been convicted of it.
Yeah, but he's still the same.
Keeping it honest. Keeping it honest.
Pardon, George?
Keeping it honest.
Yeah, just keeping it honest. You're starting to break up on my side. So if I don't catch the questions, I'll just ask you again.
Okay.
What was useful about that whole thing in 2003, George, was that that was a natural event, all right? It was a natural whip-up, and it had the pattern of a natural whip-up. And I will tell you, after it was about, I think, in June, it was supposed to be there in May, didn't show up, everyone's kind of wait, you know, give it 30 days, see if the check's in the mail. It didn't show up, and in June, the topic collapsed. In August of that year, we published an article, Is It Time to Revisit Planet X? Besides us, four other people read it, okay? But the topic keeps coming back because it's the only thing that explains all of the crazy stuff that is happening to our world.
Well, and there's lots.
Yeah, and there's a lot of it. There's a lot of it right now, and we're seeing, seabeds are rising. I'm more concerned, frankly, with what's happening below the water than I am what's happening on land. 70% of the planet is covered with water. And, you know, it's so easy for us when we have this, if I don't see it with my own two eyes, it doesn't exist, all right? Well, we can't see what's happening to 70% of the planet. But there's a lot that's happening, and that's the part that really worries me, because you have seabeds that are rising and falling. You have subsea volcanism. We're watching right now in the Canary Islands. That is a real hot point for everybody on the East Coast, because the Canary Islands starting to have microquake swarming activity.
Well, and if that La Palma volcano goes, the whole thing goes, doesn't it?
If La Palma goes, the western flank collapses because it's already weakened from an eruption that happened shortly after World War II. And that western flank of that volcano collapses, it's going to send a wall of water across the Atlantic at the speed of a jet airplane. And from Maine to Florida, we get hosed.
Yeah, we do, big time. And how far in? 20 miles, maybe?
40.
Jeez. That's a lot of space.
From inland as far as 40 miles. That's how big it's going to be. That's how powerful it's going to be. So, and the thing of it is that once that happens, it's 8 hours. You know, and try to get out of New York City in 8 hours. I mean, it's everything will jam up, and people are just going to drown like rats if they're not watching it. So, I mean, if I were living on the East Coast, every day I would be monitoring the Canary Islands, because that is threat number one. If you're living on the West Coast, you're monitoring Cascadia. If you're living in the center of the country, you're monitoring what's happening at Yellowstone. Those are your principal major threat things that you have to keep on the radar scope.
Well, and that caldera is long overdue, isn't it?
Pardon?
That caldera is long overdue.
Yeah.
In Yellowstone.
They put it, they red listed that thing, and it hasn't come off red list. So we have, and there's a tremendous amount of volcanism that's going on right now. That's all around the world. We have a lot of volcanoes that have been dormant for a long time that are getting active again. You're seeing, you know, all of these patterns, and we have sensor, you know, the interesting thing is that the sensor buoys keep going out. You know, we all of a sudden, for years, all of these sensors, all of these buoys out there that were measuring the water column were stable and never had a problem. All of a sudden, there's all kinds of technical problems, which usually happen after a massive shift in a seabed. I'm talking about seabeds going up and down in huge amounts. And so there's all of this subsea volcanism, everything that's going on. The sun right now is peculiar odd. I think what's really interesting for me is that the, you know, we don't have, there's very little Earth-directed activity. There's very little activity that's happening on our side. When these, we're seeing these flares and CMEs, it's on the other side of the sun. That for me is an interesting thing. But also I'm looking at Bluebonnet, this object, or the Blue Kachina, if that's what we're looking at. It's on the other side of the sun as well. So there's all of these factors. But then if you just take a step back from that, George, and you look at what is happening with our own country, what are governments doing in response to all of this? You know, for example, the government is, for agencies that are not frontline active combat agencies, they're buying billions of rounds of ammunition.
Yep. Social Security, Homeland Security.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense.
NOAA. What does NOAA need a million bullets for?
A billion.
A million. Or whatever, there, it doesn't matter what, you know, when we start to get to the millions and the billions, it's like, there's, how are you going to get out to the range and shoot this stuff in a century? Okay.
So your theory is that this planet that's coming closer and closer is going to have havoc on this planet again, and they, the power brokers, are going to get ready for it.
They're already ready. And what I can tell you is this is definitely something you want to look for. When you start seeing corporate jets littering the tarmac at Denver like a bad case of measles,
something's going on.
Time is near.
Something is going on. And again, what's the timetable?
The timetable?
Yeah.
I think in terms of what I'm looking at, for me, it's always been, you know, for all the years I've come on your show, I've always said the same thing. 2012 is the warm-up band. The headline act is 2013. Whatever's going to pop is going to pop this year. If nothing happens this year, which would just plumb tickle me to death, then at that point we can say, all right, maybe we, you know, we were lucky and it's a benign flyby. We've only had a bit of disruption and we'll get through this and things are going to be calm.
At least this time.
But on the other hand, it could be, you know, by the time we finish this year, we're going to see all kinds of havoc that's going on. I mean, look at the financial system of the world. Doesn't it look more like a bunch of guys running around with duct tape?
Oh, yeah. People are acting weird.
Yeah.
Maybe it's got some kind of gravitational pull on people. I don't know. Or primarily water.
I think people are sensing it. I think this is a deep-rooted fear that I think that's what I'm finding. And this is news for me. Was, you know, when I'm looking at this and I'm going, wow, we have something interesting to look at. And guess what? You can go look at it with us too, and you can see it live. And people don't want to do it. They don't want to do it. There's that. It triggers this massive fear response in them. And, you know, they start babbling with trivia and they get angry if you want to discuss it. And they storm off and they don't want to deal with it. But the fact is, it's there, and I'm seeing it every day. And it defies logic as to why people don't want to look at it, but they do. I think folks are sensing it. For example, the government right now, Homeland Security, is running around with MRAPs, all right? These are the vehicles we developed for our soldiers in Iraq.
That's right.
So that the IEDs wouldn't take them out.
They're here.
Well, now they've got them here. I don't know. George, do you know anybody that's got a few 155-millimeter howitzer shells laying around?
No, I don't think so. And they got 2,700 of these vehicles, Marshall. We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM, and we'll take phone calls with you. We'll be back.